This week in the studio, Rick Wakeman, Bill Bruford, Steve Howe, and John Anderson. All of Yes get incredibly close to the edge.
Close to the end, down by the river. Seasons will pass you by. Get up. Get down.
I think there was a unified feeling about doing Close to the Edge. That was a moment in time. It never happened again and never will happen again the way that that happened. It was a collective knowledge that we were embarking on something a little bit new, a little bit uncharted territory. And I think that's one of the things that make Close to the Edge as perennial as it is. Hello, this is John Anderson of Yes.
Hi, this is Rick Wakeman of Yes.
Hello, this is Bill Bruford of Yes.
And this is Steve Howe of Yes, and you're in the studio for the 1972 Close to the Edge experience.
For the first dozen years of rock, it was generally accepted that pop songs should be no longer than 3.5 minutes. Anything beyond that, it was believed, would be lost on the short attention span of the all-important teenage radio listener. But in the late 60s, a few years after the initial British invasion, a second wave of English rock bands challenged this standard precept. The simple rule of this new movement, dubbed art rock or progressive rock, was that there were no rules. And by 1972, the band Yes was at the apex of this progressive rock movement. During their most innovative period, the musical painters were singer John Anderson, guitarist Steve Howe, drummer Bill Bruford, bass player Chris Squire, and keyboardist Rick Wakeman. In the fall of 1972, Yes released Close to the Edge, just 9 months after their breakthrough album in America, Fragile, which had clearly proven that commercial acceptance could be achieved without compromising Yes's musical integrity. Excited by their newfound popularity, Yes went back in the studio with producer Eddie Offord and painstakingly recorded Close to the Edge in between concerts on their Fragile tour. As Rick Wakeman recalls, it was a phenomenal period for Yes.
Well, my recollection at the time was that of a certain amount of power, because you knew that just the way that record company and managements and people around you reacted. The best way I can describe it is if you're a successful comedian, people will laugh at your jokes even if they're not funny. And people started to gather around us like the proverbial bees around a honeypot, or flies around a honeypot, whichever you like to call them. Really.
You knew you were hot.
Oh, yeah. You knew you were hot. You knew you had something. The strange thing was, I don't think any of us really, to be brutally honest, knew quite what it was. The thing that we'd done on Fragile was break a lot of rules. We'd broken a lot of rules with pieces, especially like Heart of the Sunrise and Roundabout, with having lots of different tempos, moods, times, everything that you shouldn't really do on a rock record, we did. And the great thing was for us that America loved it. It was tremendous. You knew you had something special to offer. It was very strange. But the other great thing as well was we as musicians were ahead of the technology, and we were ahead of the studios, and we were ahead of the record company and management, who had no idea really where we were going, but knew, to put it crudely, that it was making their money, so let them get on with it. And that was the secret of Yes, and we knew it.
guitarist Steve Howe and former drummer Bill Bruford of Yes.
We were all immersed in the fact that Yes were getting somewhere. We didn't have the full realization of the pressure that, well, we had to live up to something believable. But mind you, Fragile had really put us on the map and roundabout, certainly in the States. So I dare say we were blindly confident that something would come out of the
something,
air.
Something would turn up.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that still is really a prime thing in the band, I think.
Oh,
something
yes.
will turn up.
I don't think there's a band that doesn't exist like this. It's almost like when you look back afterwards, everybody thinks we had so much, you know, conceptual idea.
People always think, especially in America, they have this idea that we knew what we were doing, which of course we didn't. And that's the way some of the best things, I think, occur, you know.
Assassin Point!
Here's Rick Wakeman.
The classic with Close to the Edge was we'd recorded the whole of the last section, which had to be all tagged on to what was already in existence, which was basically after the big organ solo and all the various bits and pieces. The bin for the scrap tapes that we didn't want was out in the with the garbage all out at the back and all chopped up. And Eddie had taken the piece that he thought was the right piece and put it on, and it was the wrong piece. And the interesting thing was, it was the best performance, but there was an incredible sound change. I mean, a real phenomenal sound change, which was mainly caused through the echo that had been used on the mix. And we all listened to it and looked at each other, and there was nothing we could do about it. Short of going in and starting recording again, but the odds of getting the same sounds that we had to match on, I mean, we were just, it was an impossibility. So that stayed. Now, the interesting thing is, after about four or five listens, it sounded perfectly natural. And you can hear it. You can hear it on the record to this day. And it's an unbelievable sound change. But, you know, nobody, the record company, nobody ever picked up on it. Nobody ever noticed.
Get up!
There was an interesting thing about a lot of the music at that time, and it shows up now. The music, pieces like And You and I, Close to the Edge, were bigger than the band. They were more important than the band or any individual. They were more powerful than the band. There are certain pieces of Yes music that are in control of you rather than you being in control of it. And You and I is undoubtedly one of them. Close to the Edge for me is another, and The Awakening is another. So it's amazing to have two such pieces on one album.
That was Rick Wakeman with the Yes title song to the album 1972's Close to the Edge. Up next, we'll find out what inspired the lyrics to that incredible piece of music. This is Redbeard asking you to please help Houston and the Texas Gulf Coast residents devastated by Hurricane Harvey by donating now to the Salvation Army. Toll free 1-800-SAL-ARMY. That's 1-800-SAL-ARMY. Toll free. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the anniversary of Close to the Edge by Yes.
Hello, this is John Anderson of Yes.
Hi, this is Rick Wakeman of Yes.
Hello, this is Bill Bruford of Yes.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Steve Howe of Yes with Redbeard.
Thanks, Steve. These days it's quite common for record companies and band management to frequently visit rock bands in the studio, offering advice and suggestions. But as John Anderson and Rick Wakeman remember it, one of the reasons Yes was able to be experimental and adventurous with Close to the Edge was because during the whole recording process, Yes's record label left them alone. First, lead singer John Anderson with me in the studio.
Close to the Edge, you know, the record company didn't come near the nobody came near
the
studio.
So Phil came down a couple of times, but they had no idea what was going on.
They had no idea how long we were doing this piece of music, and what did it all mean, and You and I, and Katru, and things like that.
Very funny, actually.
It was just a remarkable time of freedom. The interesting thing that we aspired to at that time was to create music that hadn't been thought of before, music that hadn't been heard before. It wasn't any retro anything. It was based on our collective talents, using a spiritual theme, because Close to the Edge is close to the edge of realization, of self-realization. That's what the theme was all about. It was all based on a book that I had read called Siddhartha from Hermann Hesse. So there we were on the edge of learning about our potential as artists, as musicians, in order to, you know, jump into a new world of music. And that's what Close to the Edge was all about. And it did push us in a direct fashion into the limelight of, one could say, total progressive music, to the point that today we can perform years later, And You and I, and it still, in fact, now has more power than it ever had.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable piece of music, as though it was crafted by the heavens, and we were just the vehicles in order to pull it together.
Left to their own devices, Yes charted their own course, undaunted by musical trends. Supremely confident that their fans were up to it, Yes challenged their audience to accompany them on musical journeys lasting as long as an entire side of an album. Their confidence did not go unrewarded. Within a month of its release, Close to the Edge hit number 4 in the UK, number 3 on the American album chart, the highest position ever attained by Yes. Clearly in 1972, Yes was on top of its game. Again, here's Rick Wakeman.
And the great thing is, if you stay way ahead of the game, then to a certain extent the people around you are frightened and will let you carry on. And that's where Yes was. Yes, at that time as a band, was so far ahead of the game that all around couldn't get involved because they didn't understand what was going on. It was tremendous. It was a phenomenal period of time. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't really understand what was going on. And I don't think any of us did. We all like to believe we did. But a number of times I got asked questions like, well, how do you put together music like this? And the best you could come up with is, well, it's a catalytic element. Music is the catalytic element of 5 completely different characters that all happen to be put together to work musically, with different ideas, different upbringings, different musical backgrounds, all capable of playing, and the music ends up as the catalytic element. And that was the sort of the best that anybody could really come up with, because nobody really knew.
Contrary to what you might expect of symphonic arrangements, such as Yes was doing on the album Close to the Edge, none of it was written out. Secondly, one of the group's main songwriters, John Anderson, was the one member who had no formal musical training. Instead, Anderson had the enviable gift of being able to hear melodies in his head. The challenge for John Anderson then was how to present these songs to the rest of the band. Drummer Bill Bruford explains.
Usually, he presented them with a great deal of vigor, a great deal of muscle, and a great deal of, if you don't like it, think of something better. That's usually was John's approach. So he would play something really horrendously terrible. And most people would say, oh, do we have to play this? Oh, no. Well, all right, if we've got to, why don't you put the sixth there in the chord and play it like that? And then somebody would say, yeah, but if you put an F in the bass instead of the G root, then it'll sound better. And you see what happens. The original idea would become turned into music by the four competent musicians around him. So he would bang out some horrendous, god-awful noise over one chord, getting his fingers caught in the strings, with a look in his eyes which said, if you don't like this, quit or make it better. Which is a technique, you know, that Hitler would use. Somewhere slightly to the right of Hitler. And of course, people would say, oh, you know, do I have to leave the group? No. All right, well, let's tell him that if you move the G6 to the G-6, then it'll sound really good, you know. And so that's what would happen. And then somebody would say, well, that sounds quite good. And hey, presto, the ball is up and running. Often used by band leaders in some way or another. It's throwing down a gauntlet saying, I'm doing this. If you guys can like it, or you can leave it, or you can improve it. So we'd improve it.
From Close to the Edge, that's Yes, with the enigmatic Siberian Katru. When we come back, we'll get the inside scoop on how Yes arranged their incredibly complex music in the early 1970s. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the 45th anniversary of Close to the Edge by Yes.
Hello, this is John Anderson of Yes.
Hi, this is Rick Wakeman of Yes.
Hello, this is Bill Bruford of Yes.
And this is Steve Howe of Yes, and you're in the studio for the 1972 Close to the Edge experience.
I'm Redbeard. Remember, Yes did not score their musical arrangements ahead of time. Instead, the late Chris Squire, John Anderson, Steve Howe, Rick Wakeman, and Bill Bruford would sit in the studio and bang it out one chord at a time. Drummer Bill Bruford.
What should astound you is the sheer lunacy of trying to attempt such a thing. And if, of course, we'd known how horrible it was going to be, we would never have done it. But it's like five guys trying to write a novel at the same time. You know, one guy has a good beginning, and the second guy has quite a good middle, and the third guy thinks he knows what the ending is, but the fourth guy doesn't like the middle, and he doesn't like the way the middle goes towards the ending. And the second guy, who used to like the third section, has changed his mind and now likes the first section. You see what I mean? It's obviously a nightmare. And very sensibly, people now don't have the time or inclination to work at music that way. So it was a very unusual way to do it.
Yes, guitarist Steve Howe.
But I remember the sort of chaos that we were in within You and I. We had this song before we knew what happened after da 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 da, you know, three of those. It was like going somewhere and we were all going, but where? And I remember we had, you know, like, amen, amen. We had this two chords at the end. And the idea was that the first chord was just going to go on for an indefinite sort of vanilla fudge sort of length, you know, where you're just going to like hold this chord and everybody was going to boogie on one chord, man, you know, groove on a chord, you know. There's no rhythm. It's just, and so it got to be like, these people were trying to sustain this note and keyboards were hammering this note and Bill was most probably hitting something. And then eventually, like with great relief, it went, you know. And we listened to this a few times and kind of, well, that's great ending. It's a good ending. It's not a bad ending. It's an average ending. It's a pretty lousy ending. So gradually its popularity diminished, you know. And John and I went out there with voice and guitar and sort of did a sort of a shape for an ending. We didn't have an end. So in a way, we were. It was almost the blind leading the blind. But this thing, as Bill said, the fact that we didn't know how good what we were doing was is almost what enabled us to be very progressive, very explorative. It made it more exciting because we were all so stupid in those days. We were all so, you know, I was going to say dumb, but I don't know how you'd express it. We were just green, that's it. We say in England, green, wet behind the ears. We didn't know what we were doing, and this was the marvellous expedition that we were on.
Yes, lead singer John Anderson, followed by keyboard player Rick Wakeman.
We were making music, and we'd stop when it was finished, look at each other and say, well, that's great, what is it? And they'll say, it's 12 minutes long. Wow. Well, we'll just tighten that up a bit. And, you know, hey, it's 10 minutes long. Wow. We were more surprised than anybody that it was long. We just made music until it was finished.
So I can play you lots of music from that era that's 10 minutes long from other people and things, a pile of junk. You know, I can play you 3-minute pieces of music that are piles of junk. What counts is a piece of music that counts for every minute that it's there.
Yeah. You let it happen.
We never timed anything, as John said, at the end of it. How long was that? And Eddie might go, well, that's 6.5 minutes, and you're only at the end of the first verse.
Complete.
It was torture. None of us, these music, these arrangements weren't written, so no, and they weren't really composed, so that we all sat in a rehearsal room and said, well, let's have a G after the G sharp. And every instrument was up for a democratic election, you know, and everybody had to run an election campaign on every issue. And it was horrible. I mean, it was incredibly unpleasant and unbelievably hard work. And Squire was always late, of course, to every rehearsal. And after about, what, 2 months of this?
Yeah, months. I mean, months. Used to do this for my punishment.
It was unbelievable punishment. And people say to me, Bill, why, you know, didn't you do another one? I mean, do you understand why I didn't do another one? I wasn't going to go through that again. It was horrible. It was torture.
Sad preacher nailed upon the colored door of time. Insane teacher, be there, reminded of. Shall certify political ends, our sad remains will die. Reach out as forward taste begin to enter you. Oh, oh. I listen hard.
I think there was a unified feeling about doing Close to the Edge that was a moment in time. It never happened again and never will happen again the way that that happened. It was the weather, it was London, it was AdVision Studios, it was the atmosphere. It was a collective knowledge that we were embarking on something a little bit new, a little bit uncharted territory. And I think that's one of the things that make Close to the Edge as perennial as it is.
And you and I clock crossing the shapes of the morning. And you and I reach over the sun for the river. And you and I climb clearer towards the movement. And you and I gold over valleys of endless.
That's the breathtaking song And You and I from Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees Yes and Close to the Edge. I'm Redbeard. I'll be right back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking all my guests and dedicating this edition of In the Studio to the late Chris Squire. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Red Beard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2017, all rights reserved. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.